Right? Yeah, then, no, it just takes a while to. I know, it just takes a while till it starts working.
Yeah,
so
and then we'll switch it off once.
Yeah. There we are, starting now. Okay, page 838. Yeah, ready to go? Page 838, Parshas Chukas and Bullock. It's a double Parsha this week. Well, that's just about to explain that. What happens is that, that's okay. Fascinating thing, this week we catch up with the land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael. What happened was, just for those who didn't quite get it, on Shavuot we had 2 days of Yom Tovir, Friday and Shabbos. For us, in Israel only have 1 day. So for us, the Shabbos was a yontif, not a regular parsha. Whenever we have a yontif, we don't read the regular parsha, we read the special parsha. And therefore we got behind. So the week after Shavuot for us was Parshas Nosoi, where in Israel it was already Baal Loischa, it was a parsha ahead, because they didn't have a second day Shavuot, so for them it was a regular Shabbos. And that happens sometimes. It happens particularly around Shavuot time. It can happen around Pesach time as well. And it's actually quite... it's funny because they just be like different parshas, and you know, it happens every few years. It happens quite, yeah, relatively often. And it's a funny thing because nowadays it affects a lot, because nowadays there's much more travel and communication and emails coming out and publications coming out. And the last few weeks it's been very confusing, because, like, you know, I get various publications out of Israel on the various parshas, and I had to print a week like behind because I get the email, but it's the wrong email because it's a parsha ahead. You know, very funny. My son was just telling me, he was in New York now for Gimel Tammuz, the third day of Tammuz. You know, there was a very, very big crowd at the Rebbe's Oil for Shabbos, and various minyanim for Shachris, and he joined the wrong minyan, because he joined the minyan, then it came to the reading of the Torah. He realized he was reading the wrong one, because they were a whole bunch of guests from Israel who were making their own minyan, because they were holding somebody else. It was very funny. So you had to go join a different minyan to get the right parsha. Anyway. No, it will take a second.
I thought you might have it on.
No, it's definitely on heat. You know, it'll just take a few minutes. It'll, right? So what happens is, whenever that happens, around Shavuos time, it has to wait till this parsha. Because last week in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, it was Chukas. This week in Israel, it's a single parsha, Balak, and we do a double parsha, Chukas, Balak. Because not every parsha can be double. This is one of them that could be. And therefore, we catch up. So this Shabbos, we read a double parsha here. Yeah, we read double, they read single, and then we've caught up. So by next, so this Shabbos we catch up, and next Shabbos we're
on par.
No, because the reason, that's a good question, because the reason that there's double parshas is for a whole host of reasons. In other words, there's a whole system of double parshas to structure the, why do we have double parshas altogether? Because we have, in fact, it's very rare, right? It's very rare that we should actually have a year where we read every parsha single. It happened a few years ago. It's a fascinating structure of the calendar. Because what happens is like this. We have a system, we have two things that affect the parshas, affect the Torah reading. One is the fact that when Shabbos and Yom Tov coincide, there's no parsha. We read a separate parsha, or we read a special Yom Tov thing. The second is the leap year issue. So sometimes we have an extra month. So we've got to allow. And the idea is that we start the Torah on the Shabbos after Simchas Torah, and we end it on Simchas Torah, right? So we've got to allow for a system where, in the maximum amount of free Shabbosim in the year, we'll always have a parsha, right? So they structured in such a way where every so, not very often, I think it's once in six, once in seven maybe years, it happens that there's a year where you've got so many free Shabbosim, meaning you've got a leap year, plus the amount of days of Shabbos that coincide with Yom Tov aren't that many, because it can vary. I'll give you an example. Pesach, for example, can sometimes only have one. Pesach is 8 days, right? So sometimes it can have two Shabbos. And if it starts on a Shabbos, it'll end on a Shabbos. So then you've got two Shabbos that aren't spare. But then normally it's only one Shabbos, right? Like, for example, and same thing this year with, like this year with Sukkot, same thing. It starts on a Shabbos, ends on a Shabbos. So it depends. It can vary from year to year. So there's a type of year, right? There's a type of year where there's one type of year where it's a leap year, plus not that many Shabbosim fall out on the Yom Tov, where you need every single parsha in the Torah, right? Okay, so that's how it works. But most years that doesn't happen. So most years you've got to double up. But the doubling up is done in such a way where it was very carefully designed that certain parshas will always come out in certain places. For example, Parshas Devarim will always be read the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, because it's got a connection. The Shabbos Parshas Nitzavim will always be read before Rosh Hashanah. Bamidbar will always be before Shavuot, etc. So there's a certain system that has to fall into place. In order to design it in such a way where it fits for leap years and it doesn't, and we've got a double up for the non-leap years, and all, that year we've got Tzvei Shabbosim, it worked out that there's certain designated Parshas that go together to facilitate the system. It's a brilliant system, but it works. That's how it works. So Chukas Bolak is one of these double parshas, right? It's interesting, a lot of double parshas actually come in the book of Vayikra, right? Which is very understandable, because at the end of Shmois and Vayikra. See, it's interesting that the beginning of Shmois, Bereishis doesn't have any double parshas, right? And Shmois doesn't have for the first few, only towards the end. So most of the double parashas are the end of the book of Shmois and in the middle of Vayikra. Why? Because, think about it, what happens is we start reading the Torah, the Shabbos after Simchas Torah, right? Until the month of Adar, there's never an issue. Until the month of Adar, there's no Yontif and there's no extra month. So things are always pretty uniform then. So that's why there's no double parashas then. Where it starts to get messy is Purim time, when there's an extra Adar, Pesach, and Shavuos. So that's around that part of the Torah, that's where you find all double parashas. And then, of course, what's that? And then at the end, also around Rosh Hashanah, you find, like, around the end of Dvarim, you also find, because that's around where Tishrei is, and Tishrei, it all gets messed up because, you know, for example, like, we've got to make sure we finish the Torah on Simchas Torah. But, like, sometimes, and we also have to make sure that Nitzavim is always before Rosh Hashanah. Problem is, sometimes there's two more Shabbosim after Nitzavim, sometimes only one. Right? It works very simple. When Rosh Hashanah is on Tuesday or Wednesday, then there's two more spare Shabbosim until Simchat Torah. If Simchat Torah is any other day, then there won't be. There'll only be one more spare Shabbos. It'll be the Shabbos between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but there won't be a Shabbos between Yom Kippur and Sukkot. And then during Sukkot, of course, it's a Yontif, so it's a different parasha. So it's a... There's a lot in the system. Sorry? Yeah, and it's like same thing with a calendar. I mean, it's actually brilliant. I mean, when you think about when all these systems and structures were actually designed, way pre-programming time, it's actually phenomenal. It's actually an incredibly phenomenal system. I mean, the calendar is even more phenomenal. The calendar, the 19-year cycle, how it's worked out to the last finest detail about which years have, you know, leap years, and which years, which ones are 31 days, which ones are 30 days, which ones are 29 days. Some years it varies, and exactly how. Hillel. Well, the calendar was Hillel. Hillel the second, that is. Hillel the Babylonian sage. Not Hillel as in base Hillel. It comes from him mainly, yeah. I mean, there were variations of it, but then it's a system based on his system. But, I mean, you're talking, just to give you a sense of history, you're talking about around the 3rd century, right? So that's not much later than that. Also not...
But what the actual differences?
Yeah, because that's why I say not much later than that, because the parashas had two systems at that time. There were two. One system to read the parasha, to finish the whole Torah in 1 year, and there was one system to finish the whole Torah in 3 years. But eventually the system of 1 year became accepted, and that became the system. But also that was a little bit later. That was finalized, you could say. The system was there before, but it was absolutely finalized around the time of the Gaonim, which is more the 6th, 7th century. But yeah, they're amazing systems. They all work. Okay.
Now, do you have a list of when there's two parts, or you just go according to what you see in the book?
I had it on this week. Oh, I look at the calendar.
I look
at the Bina calendar.
The Bina calendar.
Whatever it tells me to do, that's what I do.
Who puts it there first?
No, there's very set systems. I find these things hazy. Nowadays you have calendars on the internet galore, but so you can look ahead. But there's very set systems. I mean, my grandfather once told me that when he first came to South Africa, there was a year where there needed to be a calendar, and there wasn't. And actually, it was a bit late, and they hadn't received the calendar from overseas. Now we're talking about days. There was no faxes, and he actually had to devise a calendar for Rosh Hashanah. So he showed me, it's an amazing thing, the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote the Mishnah Berurah, has a condensed summary of how to make a calendar in brief. But it's not the whole thing, it's based on the previous year. In other words, once you know what was this year, so you can work it out what's next year. but there's a set system because it's a 19-year cycle. Mm-hmm. So you just have to know which, like, it's already pre-programmed because in the 19 years, they're all the same. In other words, so you know exactly what's going to happen in each one of the 19 years. Which number? I don't know which number the 19 years. I'm not sure. It's not my area. I mean, I can tell you a little bit about it, but it's not my area of expertise. But it's in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch has a whole section where it goes through this whole thing, and the tour. Tour is a very famous part where he goes through the whole system and explains exactly how to do it. And the Rambam is a bit of a... Yeah, it's all. All right, that was a bit of a lengthy introduction, so... So, because we have two parshas, so what I'm going to try and do is just spend a bit of time at each, because they're actually very unrelated. Sometimes you have two parshas, it kind of is a bit of a connection. This week, I'm sure there is a connection, but it's really two separate topics, two separate themes altogether. This is something. Yeah. So the first parsha is Parshas Chukas, page 838. Just learn a little bit. The first part of the Torah, first part of the parsha talks about the famous mitzvah called the Para Aduma, the red cow, the red heifer, whatever you call it. And let's read a few psukim inside. It's page 838, chapter 19, verse 1, pasuk aleph. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe vel Aaron leimer. Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron, saying, Zois Chukas haTorah. What I'm going to tell you, says Hashem, says God, this is the chukah, this is the statute, this is the law of the Torah. Asher tziva Hashem leimer, that Hashem has commanded you to give over. Dabar el b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of b'nei Yisrael, v'yikhu eilecha, and they should bring to you, para aduma, a red cow, tamima, it's going to be a perfect cow, in other words, it's going to be unblemished. Asher ein b'mum, it has no blemish. Asher loy ola oleha oil, and upon which a yoke has not come, in other words, the cow has not worked, it hasn't carried anything. What should you do? Now the Torah begins to describe the whole procedure of what should be done with the red cow. There was a whole process in the preparation of this red cow. Essentially, this red cow was considered a korban. It was considered a sacrifice like other sacrifices. The difference being that every other sacrifice was brought on the altar in the Mizbeach, in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. This was done outside. This was done on a mountain overlooking, in fact, where it was prepared. Not in the desert. The desert, of course, was done in the desert. But in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, when they used to prepare this red cow, it was done on Har HaZeisim, what we call today Mount Olives. Right? Which is a fascinating thing. That was the purpose of this red cow, as we'll soon explain, is to purify people who have become impure by coming into contact with a dead body. Right? And the solution that they prepared with the water and everything would be sprinkled upon the person that would cause them to become pure. And that was prepared on Har HaZeisim, Mount Olives, overlooking the temple. And there's some tradition that ultimately, Tchias HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead that will take place when Mashiach comes, will begin from the mountain of Har HaZeisim, which is the reason that over the ages, Har HaZeisim became a cemetery. And today it's a very famous cemetery, of course. People are, I mean, it's actually full, apparently, but people are buried on Har HaZeisim. That was the mountain that would actually prepare the Parah Aduma, right? So, what happened with it? Unasatem oisa, says we verse 3, Unasatem oisa el Elazar hakohen. You should give this to Elazar the kohen. He was the son of Aaron hakohen. V'hoitzi oisa mechutz lamachane. He should take it out of the camp. It needs to be done away from the general suburb. V'shachat oisa lefonav, and he should slaughter it. And then there's a whole procedure of what has to be done with it. It has to be burnt, and the ashes have to be mixed with water. And it's got to take a certain plant and has to have a solution. That solution was then divided into three parts, right? It was a solution of a mixture of ashes and water, which we'll mention later. And then that solution was divided into three parts. That one part was used, and I'll soon explain what it was used for. The second part was then mixed into the next paraduma. It was kept to be mixed, like when they prepared another one, they had to always have a part of the previous one. And the third one was just kept for safekeeping in the base of Mikdash as a reminder, as something that wasn't used, it was just kept for forever. What was the purpose of this paraduma? The purpose was that we know in the Torah we have a large section of the laws of the Torah that deal with purity and impurity. We dealt with this, I think it was Parshas Tazria, we gave a lengthy explanation on it. Right? Now the laws of purity and impurity are very abstract, very unknown to us, the specifics of exactly how it works, but we do know that there's a concept of purity and impurity. A person can become impure, and a person can then be purified. We don't know exactly what that means and how it happens, but we do know that it's got to do with something to do with the absence of life. I explained that at great length the last time we spoke about this. Right? So, now, in the laws of purity and impurity, there's various degrees. There's various degrees of tumah. There's various degrees of purity and impurity. The highest degree of impurity is a dead body. For the purpose, by the way, because it's the highest degree of holiness. We know that the degree of impurity is always proportionate to the degree of holiness. In other words, the more life that there was, the greater the vacuum and the greater the absence when that life leaves, and therefore the greater the impurity that could be generated, right? So the highest level of impurity that a person can contract, so to speak, is coming into contact with a dead body. And there's three ways that can happen. Either coming into contact with the dead body itself, or being in the same room as the dead body, or coming within a certain distance of a grave, right? And that's how a person sort of catches this level of impurity. Now, there are many, many other forms and levels of impurity in the Torah, of which normally the process of purification is mikveh, right? Mikveh is a transformation process, and a person goes to mikveh, they become pure from the impurity that they had contracted. Nowadays, people don't necessarily go to mikveh for every level of impurity, other than a woman. But because there's no obligation, because today we're all considered impure and we don't have the restrictions that they had in the time of the temple. Because in other words, today we don't eat sacrificial food, we don't go into the temple, we don't engage in the activities that one is obligated to be absolutely pure for. And therefore one doesn't have a mitzvah to get rid of this impurity. Now, the highest level of impurity, as I said, is coming into contact with the dead body. For that, mikveh is not sufficient. If someone had to come into contact with a dead body, and then they wanted to engage in an activity that required purity, right? They had to go to mikveh, but mikveh wasn't sufficient. They needed the parah aduma, they needed the red cow. And basically, in a very summary form, the process was like this: that this solution, this preparation of parah aduma, that was a combination of the ashes of the red cow mixed in with spring water, live water. It's called Natura, live water, Mayim Chaim, was then sprinkled by a Kohen on the person who was impure over a period of 7 days. And it was sprinkled on him on the third day and on the seventh day. And then the person would then go to mikveh, and then at night they would become pure. So that was the process of purity that a person would have to experience if they come into contact with a dead body. Now, just to give you a little bit of a historic perspective, over the time, from when this mitzvah was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, until the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, which was essentially when this whole process stopped, there were a total of 9 such cows. Because don't forget that not a lot was needed for each person, just needed to sprinkle a drop in the third day and the seventh day. It was extremely hard to find such a cow. You're talking about a cow that was born completely red, that did not have more than one black hair on his body. Right, that was the halacha. It had to be completely red.
They couldn't breed them.
No. Maybe they could, but you have to have...
Never happened.
You have to have the right parents to do that.
Yeah,
and they always only had one at a time. Like, I never had a mother and a father. Yeah. They always had one at a time.
I'm sure they tried. Maybe
it couldn't. Yeah. Well, there's a story in the Gemara, of course, about the famous story about the non-Jew who was so careful with honoring his parents, right? And the Gemara learns from there the whole, how much we have to honor our parents. And there was the story of the guy that called Dama ben Asina, who owned precious stones that the rabbis needed for some of the stones that had come loose in the breastplate of the high priest. And they came and they offered him a huge amount of money for these stones. And he couldn't sell to them because it was in a safe, and the keys to the safe were under the pillow where his father was sleeping, and refused to wake him up. So the Gemara says that he was rewarded that the next year, he was a farmer as well as a jeweler, I suppose, and the next year a para aduma, a red cow, was born to him, and it was around the time when the rabbis needed a new one because the ashes had run out from the previous one, and they came to him and they offered him a huge amount of money, and he said he doesn't want that much money, he just wants the value of the precious stones that he lost the year before. That's all he needs. He doesn't need more than that. But he was rewarded for that, right? But it was very rare and very, very expensive. Yeah, whoever was lucky to have a parah aduma, a red cow, born in his flock was made a lot of money.
I can't imagine a red cow. Oh, absolutely.
No,
No, the Arab class called. When we were kids, I don't know. We, it's called a, I don't know if here, I know in South Africa it was called a Jersey cow.
Yes,
sorry?
They're
reddish, yeah.
Call them red.
But none of them are paradumos because they always have a bit of mixture of black in them.
It's always a something, yeah. Spot.
Yeah. So they're not a
purely red. No, it wouldn't be good enough paradumo, yeah. Yeah. Now, it's a very, very strange mitzvah. And that's why the Torah calls it, begins, the opening words of the Torah is Zois Chukas HaTorah. This is the chukah of the Torah. In fact, the parasha is called chukas. Why? Because we know that the mitzvahs are divided into three components. There are those mitzvahs that we understand, that are rational, logical, and one could even sort of work them out without a Torah, if a Torah wasn't given, God forbid. Then there's a second set of mitzvahs which are logical once we know the reason, like eating matzah, putting on tefillin, and these things. And then there's a whole section of mitzvahs where we don't know the reason, right? And we keep them out of obedience, out of our subservience to Hashem. And those mitzvahs are called chukim, they're called statutes, they're called reasons, mitzvahs, but we don't have a reason. However, within those mitzvahs itself, like kashrus is one of those mitzvahs, not having wool and linen, right? There are many such mitzvahs that we don't necessarily know the reason, doesn't have a reason, or we know some reason, but we don't really understand it, right? And we keep it, that's part of our experience. We keep it because we demonstrate our real obedience and our real subservience to a higher reality by accepting these mitzvahs, even though we don't understand it. But within those mitzvahs itself, this one is considered the ultimate chukah. This is considered the ultimate not understood mitzvah, the ultimate irrational mitzvah. Right? For various reasons. First of all, it's a mitzvah which is very abstract. We don't understand how it works. We don't understand how a person becomes pure. We don't understand how a person becomes impure. Second of all, it was a very contradictory mitzvah. There was a very strange law, and it's built into this mitzvah, that the purpose of this paradigma was to make people who were impure, pure. And yet there was a halacha that the kohen who sprinkled the ashes and the fire on the person who was becoming pure, he himself contracted a lower level of impurity and had to go to the mikveh afterwards. So it was called a mitzvah that's matayir es hatmeim, it purifies the impure, and at the same time it was able to impurify the pure. So it was a very strange mitzvah, we have no idea how it works. And for that reason, the Torah refers to it as, because it's a very interesting phrase here at the beginning, it says Zois, right, again in Pasuk Beis, in verse 2, it says Zois Chukas HaTorah. This is the law of the Torah. It's a strange expression. It should actually say, this is the law of the calf. Not the law of the Torah. It's not the chukah of the Torah. It's a chukah of paraduma, right? So what is it called? Zois Chukas HaTorah? So the Mepharshim explain like this. First of all, it's because this is the ultimate chukah. In other words, this is, if you want an example of a chukah, if you want an example of a mitzvah that's not understood, this is it. The Kabbalists explain a little bit deeper. They say like this. That this, the reason that this is called the ultimate irrational mitzvah is because there's a difference between the other chukim and this one, according to many. The other chukim, we don't know the reason, but there is a reason. We just don't understand it. Shlomo HaMelech said, King Solomon said, that he, in his wisdom, he was able to discover the reason for all mitzvahs, even the chukim. But he said that when it came to this mitzvah, the Parah Aduma, he said, "V'hi rechoikam," and it's too distant from me, I don't understand it. And the commentaries explain that one of the reasons is because all mitzvahs have a reason, right? Some of them, we just know the reason. The reason is beyond us. In other words, it's beyond human comprehension. But human comprehension is limited. It doesn't mean it doesn't have a reason. In some level of intellect, in God's intellect, there is a reason. Parah Aduma, this mitzvah, actually doesn't have a reason. It's a mitzvah without a reason. No reason exists. Now, how can that be? How can it up? Why would Hashem tell us this and it doesn't have a reason? Right? But it gives us a little bit of insight into mitzvahs altogether. What are mitzvahs? It says that mitzvahs are an expression of the Ratzon Hashem, the will of Hashem. Right? Another way, a person, we can always understand God from the way we work, because we were created in the image of God, so to speak, right? And that's why often there's a pasuk in Tanakh where it says, "Umibasari echze elaka," from my flesh I will see God. In other words, when we understand the structure of how we work, we can understand how that works with God, so to speak. We have a number of stages, a number of components, hierarchical components that govern our existence. We have emotion, we have intellect, right? And then we have something called rotzen, desire. And in many places explained like this, that intellect governs emotion. Very often, that's, you know, cognitive therapy. If we think about something properly, we can steer our emotion, right? We can actually, like a person has, let's say, an instinctive sort of thing, he becomes angry. He thinks about it properly and develops a perspective. You can learn to control your anger by thinking about it properly. Right? But there's something within us that actually is deeper than Ratzon. Right? It's deeper. Deeper than an intellect. I mean. That's called Ratzon. It's our very, very deepest expression of who we are. It's instinctive. Our instincts. Who we are. And there's certain things that we do in life that we can't even explain ourselves. It's just we know that's us. It's an expression of who we are. Can't be explained, just an expression of who we are. Mitzvahs are also, you see, mitzvahs are not commands that God gave us as instructions how to work something out. In other words, they're not consequences of a whole intellectual process. The mitzvahs are God's desires, God's wills, God's instincts, so to speak. Some of them can be explained, and some of them cannot be explained not only to us. The Parah Adumah is the deepest mitzvah. It's a mitzvah which is an expression of God's desire. It's His instinct, so to speak, which we don't understand what that means, but it's His instinct. In other words, it doesn't have to have a reason. And that's why it's the ultimate mitzvah. It's the ultimate expression of God's desire, of God's ratzon. And not necessarily does it need to be explained altogether. And that's why it's called Zois Chukas HaTorah. It's the chukah of the Torah. Right? Another reason why the expression of the pasuk over here is the statute of the Torah rather than being the mitzvah of the cow is in the heart of the very word chukim. We say that these mitzvahs that have no reason are called chukim. Why are they called chukim? What's a chuk? What is a chuk? A chuk is a mitzvah, it's a statute, it's a law. But the word chukim has another translation. The word chukim comes from the word chakika, to be engraved. Right? To be engraved. So in Kabbalah it's explained like this, that there are two types of letters. There's letters we call written letters and engraved letters. Like we know, for example, when Hashem gave us the Torah, so in a Sefer Torah, in a Torah scroll, the letters are written, right? In the Luchos, in the tablets, when Moshe Rabbeinu gave us the Ten Commandments, the letters were engraved. What's the difference between letters that are written and letters that are engraved? So letters that are written, the ink and the parchment are two entities, two separate entities. Right? Letters that are engraved, the letters and what the letters are written on are actually one thing. Right? You cannot separate between the letters and the stone. It's one entity, one concept. And therefore they explain that there's two levels of the relationship between the letters and the paper represent the relationship between us and God. Right? That there's two levels of relationship between us and God. There's written letters and engraved letters. The written letters are when we are connected to God, but at the end of the day, us and God remain two separate entities. Right? At that level that we are bound up, we are married to God, we are connected to God, but as two separate things, it becomes still very difficult to do a mitzvah properly that we don't understand completely. Because if we're something separate, it needs to make sense to us before we do it. Right? How do we bring ourselves to keep mitzvahs that have no reason with the same enthusiasm, with the same passion, that we would keep a mitzvah that we do understand? Because generally people keep things they understand with much more excitement. If you understand something, you're passionate about it. If you don't understand something, so you just do it robotically. You don't do it with the same, as if it's your thing. Right? Because I don't understand it, so it's not me. I can do it because I'm told to do it, but it's not me, so why should I be excited about it? Why should I be passionate about it? So the Torah says there's only one way to do it. That the relationship that we have with God in Torah has to be chukas. Has to be that we discover a very deep relationship that we have between us and Hashem. And that is a relationship of engraved letters. That really, us and God are not like two separate things, we become one. The union is so strong that we become one. And therefore God's desire becomes our desire. We don't have to understand it. If it's his will, then it's our will. And therefore we were able to carry it out with the same passion that we would with a mitzvah that we understand. And that's why there's such an emphasis on the word chukas, and that's why it's called Zois Chukas HaTorah. And before we go on to the next parasha, Parashas Balak, I want to just give you a little bit of interesting historical perspective on this mitzvah. We have a rule that we've mentioned many times, that Ein Muktamu Mu'ukhar BaTorah, there's no historic chronological order to the Torah. It's quite legitimate in the Torah to have stories out of order, right? Which is true. So therefore, whenever you find something out of order, you can't really ask a question because it's not a problem, because that's what the Torah is. Yet, it's sometimes nice to understand why the Torah would misplace a story. Like, for what reason? I mean, it doesn't do it dafka, it doesn't do it stum because it doesn't have to have an order, right? There must be some reason. Now, over here in our parasha, it's not just out of order, it's completely out of order. Because when was the mitzvah of Parah Aduma actually given to the Jewish people? So we find a fascinating thing. When the Jews came out of Egypt, they traveled, right? They had a few stops until they got to the desert called the Midbar Sinai, the desert of Sinai, upon which they got the Torah, correct? Before they got to Har Sinai, they came to a place called Morah. So a location called Morah. That whole issue there with water, they didn't know what to drink, and there was water, and then they had to find eventually they had the well of Miriam. But there was a water shortage there, and they complained. It was one of the places. But it says in the Torah that in Morah, as a preview, as a preparation to getting the Torah, they were given some mitzvahs, just a few, like two or three mitzvahs, in order to prepare themselves for the giving of the Torah. Which mitzvahs were they given? They were given a sample. They were given a sample of a rational mitzvah, and that mitzvah was the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, honoring one's parents. They were given a sample of sort of the mitzvahs that are called testimonial mitzvahs, like Shabbos. They were given Shabbos, and they were given a sample of a mitzvah that makes no sense, and they were given the mitzvah of Parah Adumah. Okay. So the mitzvah of Parah Aduma, this mitzvah of the red cow, was actually given to the Jewish people even before the giving of the Torah. That's how early on in the piece this mitzvah takes place. Even though we read about the giving of the Torah in Parashat Shmos, but now, then to give you a little bit of a historic timeline, we've done this before, but just to do it briefly, the Jews come out of Egypt Pesach time, Shavuos they get the Torah. The next Pesach, the next Nisan, I should say, a year later, they have the Mishkan, which is Parashas Truma, the time of Vayakel Pekudei. Then they have Pesach, they have the mitzvah of the Pesach Sheni, the bringing of the second Pesach, which is Bar Loischa. Right? Then they have the story of Shlach, the Meraglim, which was after Shavuos, a year and 2 months after the came out of Egypt. After the Meraglim came back on Tisha B'Av, the spies came back on Tisha B'Av. Then you have the whole story of Korach, as I explained last week, of the Korach rebellion was connected to the Meraglim. So that takes place about a year and a half after they went out of Egypt. Okay? And that's where we're up to so far until we get to Parshas Chukas. So things are a little bit out of order here and there, but basically from when we read about giving of the Torah till Parshas Korach, there's a basic order to the Sedras, to the Parshas. You have a couple of stories a little bit out of place here and there, but otherwise it's basically in order until you get to Korach. Korach was the last story to happen. Then what happens in Parashas Chukas, all of a sudden, we get taken back way, all the way back to before they got the Torah, the mitzvah of Parah Aduma. Right? What happens right away after the Parah Aduma? Let's have a look. Go to page 844. Last word on the page, 844. Right? Vayishlach Moshe, right? You know it with me? Pasuk Yidalev 14. Vayishlach Moshe Malochim, and Moshe sends messengers, Mikodesh, from the place of Kodesh, or Melech Edoim, to the king of Edoim. Koy Omar Achicha Yisrael, this is what your brother, Edom was the descendants of Esav, right? So he calls him my brother. He says, this is what your brother says, you know what we had? After Yadatos, Kalatra, Shemasosni, he goes on to say, look, you know, we've come out of Mitzrayim, your long lost brother, we've been away for a while, we haven't had much contact, but now we're right here, and we're about to go into the land of Israel, and we'd like to pass by. King Edom doesn't give permission, and they end up having a war. But when does this take place? There's all of a sudden a drastic fast forward 40 years. From the middle of Parashas Chukas, they all of a sudden are 40 years later, ready to go into the land of Israel. And that's where the rest of Bamidbar takes us. And then you have the story of the tribes wanted to, you know, to settle in the 2.5 tribes, wanted to settle on the other side of the Yarden. Then you have the book of Dvarim, which is a month before Moshe Rabbeinu passes away. See, it's not what happens here. We have the story going up to a year and a half after they leave Egypt. Suddenly we have the Paraduma taking us all the way back to before they got the Torah. And right after the Paraduma, a fast forward to 40 years later, and they're about to go into the land of Israel. Very interesting historic structure to this parasha. I never noticed it actually until this morning. I was reading one of the parashas. No, it just never occurred to me. Right? And I saw that one of the commentaries explained that there's a reason for this. The reason is because as an introduction, right, as an introduction to the Jews going into Israel, the Torah takes us all the way back. Because the truth is like this, that after a year and a half, for those 40 years, not much happened. Right? The Torah was given, they're given the Torah, etc., etc., and then the 40 years they spent wandering in the desert. So that gap is not so much accounted for. And also we know that God didn't communicate with Moshe Rabbeinu much during the 40 years, except for the beginning and the end. But the Torah takes us way back to Paraduma, because Paraduma was this special mitzvah. This mitzvah which represents the ultimate connection between the Jewish people and God. The idea of chukkah, we said before, the engraving, the real bond that we have between us and Hashem, the ability to be able to connect to all mitzvahs in the way of chukkahs, right? And that's the Paraduma. So the Torah takes us all the way back, because although that mitzvah was given before the giving of the Torah, what connection between the Jewish people and God that mitzvah represented was not actually achieved until the end. In other words, when the Jews were about to go into Israel, that's when they finally achieved the ultimate closeness with God, and they achieved the closeness represented by the mitzvah of Paraduma. So it was given to them then as a technical mitzvah. They administered it. There was one cow actually in the desert already, right? But it was the first one that Moshe Rabbeinu did, the tenth one, the Rambam says will be Mashiach comes. That's a total of 10 throughout history. But the mitzvah also represents a certain relationship between us and God, and that level of relationship was only reached just before they went into the land of Israel. So that's why before the Torah is about to fast forward and tell us what happened just before they go into Israel, it rewinds and tells us mitzvah Paraduma, and then fast forwards 40 years to tell us that when that mitzvah was achieved, really the relationship was achieved at the end of the 40 years. Okay. That's a little bit on Parashas Chukkah. Now let's try and chap something on the next parasha, Parashas Bolak. Bolak is a very interesting parasha. No, in itself, the both parts are not that long, but when you combine them, they become the long. Okay, so what actually was Balak? So let's just give a bit of a summary. Balak was a king, the king of Moab, who, this is the end of the 40 years. The Jewish people are about to go into the land of Israel. They have begun the conquest of some of the preparation countries before they go into Israel. They fought a war with Sichon, they fought a war with Edom. And the king of Moab is feeling a little threatened. Right? He thinks, what's next? I might be next. He's an anti-Semite. He's someone that hates the Jewish people very deeply, we are told. And he calls upon a person by the name of Bilam. Right? That's what... I'm just giving a bit of introduction because I want to learn a few verses inside, but I want to just save time, so I'm just going to give you an introduction outside first. So he calls on Bilam. Who was Bilam? Bilam was a non-Jewish prophet. Right? The Midrash says that the non-Jews said that they also need a prophet. You know, Jews have Moshe Rabbeinu, they need a prophet too, so God sends them Bilam. Bilam was a person who had achieved a great level of prophecy, but he wasn't such a great guy. He was a wicked person, he was a person that was very self-centered, but God had given him the gift of prophecy and was able to communicate with God. Bilam was in Midian. Right? So Balak, who's the king of Moab, sends a message to Midian. The Rashi says a very interesting thing. Moab and Midian actually were long-time rivals, right? They actually didn't get on with each other; they were enemies. But sometimes, when you have a common and a third enemy, then you unite, right? So therefore, Balak and Moab and Midian aside, they now have a bigger problem than each other, and the problem is the Jewish people. So they started to unite to attack the Jewish people. So what happened? They've seen that wars don't work with the Jewish people. It doesn't work because they're not successful. The Jewish people seem to win the war. So they decided they're going to have to attack them with the very power that we have, and that's with the power of the mouth. And therefore Balak calls Bilam as a prophet, as someone who has tremendous power, to curse, to come and curse the Jewish nation. Right? Eventually Bilam comes. He's actually quite enthusiastic about the project. And we know that God, who, because ultimately he's a prophet, and therefore ultimately he's in the hands of God, and he warns Balak that that's the case. And he says, listen, I won't be able to curse them if God doesn't let me at the end of the day. And we know that what happens is that the Spirit of God rests upon him, and instead of cursing the Jewish people, he actually ends up blessing them. And we have the beautiful blessings that Bilam gives in this week's parsha. Most of the parsha actually is very poetic, very difficult actually, because we have all these beautiful blessings that Bilam gives the Jewish people, with all the prophecies about Mashiach. Very, very deep things are found specifically in the blessings of Bilam. Okay. But in his enthusiasm to go and curse the Jewish people, God actually tries to prevent him going. But we have a rule that God doesn't take away free choice from people. So therefore he allows him to go. But he puts all kinds of obstacles in his way to try and dissuade him from going to curse the Jewish people, in telling him that really it's only going to have a negative outcome for himself, which it did. He was punished at the end, because at the end he won't be able to destroy the Jewish people. He won't be able to curse them. He'll only end up in a problem with himself. So various ways God tries to prevent it. What's the famous way? So the famous way is we read the following. Let's have a look. Okay. Have a look on page 860. So he goes. So at the end, Hashem says like this. Page 860 at the top, Pasuk Chav Beis 22. Ayichar Afelikim. God was angry, ki hoylechu, that he was going. Vayisyatzev malach Hashem baderech v'satanoi. So God put an angel on the way when he was traveling to sort of stop him, to block him, to block the way. V'hu roichev al asoyne. And at that time he was riding on his donkey, his she-donkey. Ushnei ne'orav imoy, and he had two attendants with him. So, v'teira ha'osan es malach Hashem nitzah baderech. The donkey sees the angel. Not Bilam, but the donkey. V'char b'shlif v'yodei with a sword. V'tei ta'osan min aderech v'telech v'asodeh. So the donkey takes a detour and goes into the field. V'yach Bilam es ha'osan la'toysa ha'derech. So Bilam knocks, hits his donkey to put it back on the right path. So, Vayamad, so that's the first time. The angel tried to block him three times. Vayamad Malach Hashem Mishal Akramim. So the angel of God stands in the path of the vineyard, which was a much narrower path. Goder Mizev, Goder Mizev, which had a fence on either side. Vatera Hasan as Malach Hashem. So the donkey once again sees the angel. Vatilachet Salakiram pushes itself by the wall. But Tilchat is Rego Bilam, and in the process squeezes Bilam's leg. Bilam is not impressed, and he continued to hit his donkey. The angel continued. And this time the Malach stood in a very narrow place. Asher Ein Derach Lintois Yomin is small. There was absolutely no way to move right or left. And again, Vateira Osen as Malach Hashem, the donkey sees the Malach. But two bastachas Bilam, and the donkey crouches and just gives up. Vayicharach Bilam, and Bilam gets very angry. Vayach esa osan b'makel, and he hits the donkey with a stick. And then we have the famous pasuk Vayiftach Hashem es pi osan, and God opens up the mouth of the donkey, and the donkey begins to speak. That was one of the miracles. Vatoymer le Bilam, and he said to Bilam, Me'a sisi lecha, what have I done to you? Ki hikisoni ze sholosh regolim, that you've hit me these three times. It's famous, famous pasuk. What does the donkey say to Bilam? He says, why have you hit me three times? But in classical Hebrew, in the Torah Hebrew, the word for times, three times, is not shalosh regolim. It's shalosh pa'amim. Right? In Hebrew, a pa'am is a time. But this time he uses a different expression. He says, why have you hit me three regolim, three points, three times? So Rashi says, why does he use the expression three regolim? So we know regolim has many translations. The word regol can mean a time, it can mean a foot, but also means a festival. Because we have, the Jewish people have three festivals, which we call the Shalosh Regolim, right? Three festivals. Yeah? So Rashi says that the Malach turned to Bilam and says, are you crazy? Why are you trying to go and destroy a nation that keep the three festivals, the Shalosh Regalim? You're never going to succeed. So the commentaries ask the question, what do you mean the three Regalim? What do you mean the three festivals? The Yidden do lots of things. We keep lots of mitzvahs. Why did the donkey pick on the three festivals? What's so special? What's so unique about the three festivals? Also, we know that there's some connection here between also these three festivals and the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Avraham, Yisrael, Yaakov, right? In fact, the Mefarshim say a fascinating thing. You realize that the first time the donkey was blocked, there was a wide path. He detoured and he went into the field. The second time, there was a very narrow detour and he could squeeze through the fence and he squeezed Bilam's thing. And the third one was Yaakov when he... The third time, when there was no way to move, right? And the Mefarshim say a beautiful thing that it corresponds to the Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, right? Because Avraham was the first patriarch, but he had many other children who were not connected to Hashem. There was a wide detour by Avraham. Yitzchak, we know that he had two sons, Yaakov, but there was a small detour. Esau was one son that didn't stay on the right path. With Yaakov, there was no way to move right or left. There was a complete blockage. It was only all these children were righteous, and the Yidden came from all these children. And therefore, when you come from Yaakov, there's no unholiness. It's all holy, right? So that's the symbolism of the wide detour, the small fence, and the blockage. But going back to the three festivals, why the three festivals, and what's the connection of the three festivals? So I saw a beautiful chat from the Shem Mishmul from the Socha Chavarele. I mentioned him last week also. And he says like this. The Arizal says that Bilam, his intention like this, he didn't want to actually destroy the nation. What do you want to do? He wanted to cause them to stop keeping the three festivals. That's all he wanted. He wanted us to stop keeping the three Yomim Tovim. Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. Why? Why? What's wrong? Why wouldn't he want us to stop keeping all the mitzvahs? Why these things? So the Socha Chavarele explains a beautiful concept. He says there's a Mishnah which says, that describes the personality of Bilam. It says like this, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, it says that whoever has an evil eye, right, and an arrogant spirit, an ayin ra, an evil eye, ruach gevoya, an arrogant spirit, and an insatiable soul, in other words, a soul full of lust, these are the people who are the disciples of Bilam. Bilam's personality is characterized by an evil eye, an arrogant spirit, and an insatiable soul. So he says, what are these three things? He says, these three things correspond to another Mishnah, a famous Mishnah, where the Mishnah talks about the three traits that can destroy a human being. Jealousy, lust, and desire for and desire for honor, pursuit of glory. Right? Kina, taiva, and kovet. He says, those are the three things. An evil eye, that's jealousy. In other words, you're always looking at something else, you're always jealous of someone else. The desire for honor, that's an arrogant spirit. Arrogant spirit is desire, is covered, yeah? And taiva, lust, that's an insatiable soul. In other words, the three characteristics of Bilam correspond to the three characteristic traits that can destroy a human being, that will destroy a person. Those are the three things. If a person is protected from these three things, you're on the right path. A person not contract, these three things are the destroyers of the human being. Right? Jealousy, pursuit of glory, and lust. Now, we say like this, that we know that out of all the mitzvahs in the Torah, this is quite a lengthy thing, but it's actually quite amazing how it's all connected. Out of all the mitzvahs of the Torah, we know that, if a person's in danger, we know that you can violate every mitzvah, correct? If you're to save a life. But we know we have this concept of the three cardinal sins, right? The three averus, the three transgressions that come what may, a person cannot transgress them, even if it means giving up his life, right? What are they? It's idolatry, adultery, in other words, sexual immorality, and murder, right? So the Socha Chavarele says that these three sins correspond to the three character traits that will destroy a human being. So he explains the following. He says, Jealousy is the root of violence. Why are people violent? Because it starts off by being jealous of other people. And therefore there's a desire to get what they want and to have what they to have what other people have and what we don't have, and therefore it leads to theft, and theft ultimately leads to if you can't get it through theft, so there's a concept of violence. So there's a link, an incredible link between murder, ultimately between violence, which could result in murder, and jealousy. The root of murder, he says, ultimately stems from jealousy. Lust, obviously, is the source of all sexual immorality. That all comes from taiva. So therefore, that's the second adultery, which is the second avera, is rooted in lust. Idolatry is rooted in ego. That's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that whoever is egocentric is like he serves idols. Why? Because the first idol that a person serves is himself. Right? If a person is completely subservient to God, if a person is completely humble and realizes that he doesn't really have an independent entity, but he's part of a greater reality, then there's only one reality, it's the reality of a greater reality, which is God. Right? Yeshua's gaiva, the focus on self, in other words, the focus of building a reality other than God, is the first step to creating a reality outside that of God's reality. And that's, of course, the source of idolatry. And that's why there's a link between idolatry and ego. So therefore, he says like this, that jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory is connected to these three things that the Mishnah says. It's connected with the three cardinal sins, that jealousy is the root of murder, lust is the root of adultery, and ego, pursuit of honor, is the root of idolatry, which is connected to the three personality traits of Bilam. Right? Now, the Maral says that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov came to rectify and to protect us from these three sins. And corresponding to that, we have the three festivals. Each festival is there to strengthen another one of these concepts. In other words, each festival that we have in the Shalosh Regalim is a spiritual experience that we're supposed to use to protect us from these three underlying character traits that can destroy us, right? Which is connected to these three cardinal sins. How so? It says like this. Pesach, what was Pesach? Pesach was the time that the Jewish people detached themselves from the idol worship of Egypt. Right? And that's the idea of pursuit of glory, and that's the idea of idolatry. Because that was the whole idea. Pesach was the idea of taking the korban Pesach. The sheep was a deity of Mitzrayim. They had to take it away. They had to detach themselves. They had to divorce themselves from the idolatry of Egypt. And that's like Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu also was the whole idea that he went away from idol worship and the whole idea of belief in God. Right? Shavuos, he says, is the concept of combating lust. But Shavuos is the giving of Torah. Right? Torah is the code of morality of the person. When there's absence of Torah, when there's absence of the rules of Torah, when there's no guidelines, that's when you have immorality, right? That's when there's no differentiation, no distinction between right or wrong, and that's when people decide that they can follow, and they can create a new code of morality. And this new code of morality, you land up with an existence in a society like we have today, where everything's okay and everything's permissive, and there's no sense of real morality, and morality is all relative and all made up. That's because of the absence of Torah. So the only way to combat immorality, particularly sexual immorality, is through the Torah, and that's Shavuos. Shavuos is the giving of the Torah, and that's Keneged Yitzchak. Right. And finally he says, Sukkos, that is corresponds to the idea of murder, because it corresponds to the idea of jealousy. What is Sukkos? Sukkos' idea is that we're not jealous. Sukkos' idea of unity. First of all, Sukkos' idea is that we combat jealousy because we leave our worldly possessions, we leave the permanent house, and we go into a sukkah. We realize that we're all on very weak ground here. It's nothing. The person that has more than me doesn't make him stronger. We're all temporary, and we all live in a sukkah. We all live in a temporary hut for the 7 days to remind ourselves that in essence is our existence. So there's no point in being jealous of someone that has more. And second of all, sukkahs has the mitzvah of the dalad minim, the four kinds, which we know that the four kinds, each one represents a different Jew, a different type of person, and we put them together in an act of complete unity, and that unity, of course, combats that whole idea of jealousy, and therefore that prevents violence, and ultimately prevents murder. So therefore, says the Sacha Chava, that's what the donkey said to Bilam. You want to try and uproot a nation. Your goal is Shalosh Regalim. That's why it uses that expression in the Torah. Why did you hit me these Shalosh Regalim? Why are you trying to keep why are you trying to destroy a nation that wants to keep the Shalosh Regalim? In other words, Bilam says, I'm going to go and try and take away from them the Shalosh Regalim. I'm going to take away from them those three washalosh regalim, because I want them to be like me. I want to take away from them the three basic protections that they had. I want them to become violent, I want them to become immoral, I want them to become egocentric, like he was. To do that, he'd have to eliminate the observance of the three regalim, because each one is a protection against these three things, which correspond to the three cardinal sins. But the donkey says to him, you're wasting your time. Lomo ikisani, why did you hit me? Zeh sharash regalim, because you're going to uproot a nation that keeps the three regalim, you're not going to succeed. Ultimately, you'll have your downfall. Ultimately, the Jews will preserve, because they are so connected to Kedusha, they're so connected to holiness, that ultimately they will always preserve the three regalim, will always preserve the shalosh regalim, and therefore ultimately, even though they might fail, and they did fail, and they went up and down, but they'll always be protected, and eventually they'll always prevail, because they remain connected to the three principles of the three Yomim Tovim. Okay.